Hello and welcome to HIV Matters podcast. My name is Michelle Croston, and as your host, I will be facilitating interesting conversations with leading experts in the field of HIV care. The conversations will be centred around exploring ways to improve quality of life for people living with HIV. Throughout my career, I've always had a keen interest in any initiatives to improve outcomes for people living with HIV, which has led me to work with a variety of different organisations, with different healthcare professionals and activists. Here at HIV Matters, we hope to use our unique perspectives and platforms to improve knowledge and understanding with regards to HIV. In order to do this, we will engage in conversations with people living with HIV, people who have worked in the HIV sector, and sometimes a mixture of both. We hope you enjoy the episode, and if you have any ideas or questions on this or future episodes, please contact us at hello@hivmatters.co.uk. You can also follow us on Instagram at HIV Matters Podcast, or visit our website at www.hivmatterspodcast.co.uk. Don't forget to subscribe, rate and comment on our show. Today I'm being joined on the HIV Matters podcast by Linda Panton, who's a very close and dear friend to me and also been a colleague for many, many years. I'm just mindful that I will not do her bio justice, so I'm going to kindly hand over to Linda so she can introduce herself to you.
Thanks, Michelle. Hello. So my name's Linda. I am a nurse specialist in the infectious disease unit up in Edinburgh. And I've now been there over 30 years. I think it's 31 years this year. I was a student in infectious disease ward, and then I got a job. My first staffing job was in the HIV ward. It was a ward that had been built for people living with HIV. It was built in the late 80s. And so from there, I moved into the nurse specialist role and haven't left. So, and actually, I mean, I suppose it's great. People living with HIV are now, you know, less spending less time in hospital, which is great. So, but you know, at the time when I first did the nurse specialist role, it was purely for people who were in hospital because, you know, sadly they were having to be in hospital a lot. But it's great that that's now changed. And so my main role is having my own clinics in outpatients.
Thank you so much for sharing that, Linda. I'm smiling here because that kind of mirrors some of my own experiences of kind of coming into an area where it was predominantly really sick people living with HIV ward. And now, as we've kind of talked about many times off the podcast, about kind of the evolution of care and treatment, how we've kind of evolved as a result of that. So, as I've mentioned, I've worked with Linda for some time. In my role as NIVNA, and Linda is now the current chair of the National HIV Nurses Association. She's been the backbone of that association for many, many years. In the position before that, she was honorary secretary, and definitely during my tenure as chair of NIVNA, she was a great support, a great ally, and somebody I really enjoyed working with. So I was just wondering, for our listeners, if you'd be able to provide an overview of some of the highlights of your time on the NIVNA executive.
I think probably a highlight will always be the away days that we have. So, you know, it's not that we go away for a jolly, but we gather the night before and we all go out for a meal. And we started that not that long ago because we suddenly realised that we are so busy at conference and we do a lot of thinking and pulling things together on the away day in September, that it was nice to have a wee social the night before. And then we spend from about 9 o'clock till 3:30 of a day in September, and we all get into groups and we welcome our new members in the exec, and we explain a little bit about all the subgroups that go on in NIVNA, and we choose what groups we want to be in, and we have a good think about what we would like to achieve as an organisation over the next year. So that's always a highlight. I always love doing that. I mean, it's a standing joke that my train will either be delayed from Edinburgh on the way down or the way back up. I've had some horrendous train journeys going to that. That's part of the adventure as well, I think. So I always like the away days. I always like the conferences. I think you cannot beat living a conference. I think I really like it because a lot of community are involved. I think nurses, the nursing conference is always really popular, and it's lovely to see faces. I think that's a nice thing about working in HIV, I think, is because, you know, there are people who have worked in the field for so long, and it's, you know, we're all friends, and it's so lovely to see well-kent faces of the same in Scotland when you go back to the conference every year. And so I always really enjoy conference. I think it's a great way of, you know, sharing our best practice. And the best bit about my favourite part of conference, and I've probably said this at the time, is the case studies. I just love listening to case studies, and I think it's a great way of people who fancy maybe speaking a little bit but are really nervous. And because when somebody gets involved in telling you their case, they forget their nerves because they're so involved in what they're trying to tell you, and it just always comes over as so emotive that I just love the case studies. And it's really brilliant seeing abstracts and posters of, you know, less experienced staff doing their own wee projects, or so conferences are fab. And I think probably, what else have I done when I've been part of the exec? I've been part of the education committee, subcommittee, so we produced the education strategy. I think I was part of the research strategy as well. I've represented NIFNA on the Beaver treatment guidelines, so that was really great. I enjoyed doing that. And just speaking, representing NIFNA at different conferences, like speaking on injectables, it's great to be able to, you know, we get invited a lot more to, say, Beaver conferences now. They're kind of, you know, having sessions that we're all kind of speaking at. And I think that's working really well. So, yeah, lots of different. I think probably one of my favourite bits, because I think we spoke earlier about this, is one of the favourite roles on the exec is to chair the conference. So I did that in 2015. I think the theme was stigma. And I remember Sean Watson at the time, I think he was chair at the time, really worried, thinking, oh, this is only be doom and gloom. You can't have a whole conference on stigma. This will be terrible. And I was going, no, I'll be fine. Unfortunately, it worked out well because everybody who was speaking did great presentations. So, yeah, conference chair is probably one of the best roles that you can do while you're on the set.
That's amazing. Yeah, thank you for sharing that. So you've had a wealth of experience in NIFNA, have benefited so much from your time on the executive as well. And I loved the conferences and getting together. And like you said, it's so nice to see some old friends and new friends. And I think it was, I can't remember when you suggested about the case studies. And I kind of thought, yeah, why haven't we ever thought of that before? It's just kind of like a light bulb moment, because I agree with you. We've always kind of thought about encouraging people to speak at conference. And I think you're right, when you've got your head full of who said this, who said that, stats and all that, trying to present something, it can feel overwhelming. But nobody knows the care that you've given your patient better than you do. So, or knows that patient better than you. So like you said, it's just really, really nice to see people so passionate about the care they've delivered as well, which is great as well. So that's just a little plug for any of our listeners who would like to do that. It is a massive.
Yeah, absolutely. I if I could give a prize to everybody who does the case presentation, I would, because it definitely is my favourite session. So anybody listening, please put in and even putting in the abstract can be daunting, because just the way they set it, but this, to actually submit something now is a lot easier online as well. But also to get in touch if they're struggling with that because they just don't know how to put it in as an abstract, then get in touch, because if it's a case study, it can be put in slightly differently.
Yeah, definitely, I would agree. So if you are listening and thinking, oh, I'm not sure what to do or where to submit or anything like that, there's some information within the show notes that we can help support you with that. So we were talking kind of before we started recording a little bit about recruitment and retention within HIV nursing. So again, I think it probably leads on to kind of seeing lovely people at conferences, like we say, old friends and new friends, and then suddenly we've got more new friends than old friends, which is great. But actually, what do you think I'm just wondering what your perspective is on how NIVNA can attract nurses, or how do we attract nurses to HIV care, I guess is where I'm going with that.
I think we've all got a role in our workplace to try and spread the word about what NIVNA does, and, you know, particularly to students. Not everybody has John McCluskey, who's an exec, as their tutor. Certainly students up in Scotland get quite often, I mean, HIV might get mentioned once or twice, but they certainly don't get any level of projects that you would do if you were at Nottingham. So it really kind of, I think probably all of us who are working in HIV care, I think it is up to us to try and promote it as much as we can in the workplace and to students. I mean, certainly when students come to our unit, we encourage them to do the NIVNA Learn Pro, the modules, these kind of more straightforward ones. We get them to do that. And that's the nice thing about these modules, is that you don't have to be a NIVNA member, but obviously I encourage them to join because obviously student rates are really good. But the module, they can go on and do the modules and get a certificate. So they quite like doing that as part of their self-learning. And that gives a kind of good introduction, and they can learn at their own pace. It's something I probably do worry about a little bit, because I think a lot of us, you know, I said earlier, a lot of us have stayed working in HIV, and, you know, we're not getting any younger, sadly. And I think there is, you know, we're all kind of, we have seen, you know, there has already started, people are retiring. And I think that's going to, we're going to see people who have been around a long time eventually retire. And, you know, I think probably HIV at one stage was thought of as a kind of, oh, that's a really exciting topic, you know, because it was new and there was lots of research was happening in it. And I think that's probably changed a little bit. And so I do worry that we don't get the same kind of interest. But then at the same time, you know, people are living well with HIV. And I think we have to be mindful of how do we get nurses working in other general areas to start kind of learning about HIV, you know, because less and less people will be admitted to an infectious disease ward. They will be all around the hospital, and their HIV probably is not involved in anything to do with why they're in hospital. It's a very small part. As long as they get their medicines on time, then that shouldn't really be overshadowing what is going on at the time for their treatment. So, I think probably as nurses working in HIV, we've got a kind of responsibility to try and figure out how we, you know, make sure that nurses working elsewhere in our hospitals and communities and, you know, GP practice and stuff are kind of signposted to NIVNA, and to, you know, we can then direct them on for further, you know, knowledge and stuff.
I was just smiling as you were saying that, because it reminds me of, I think, one of my first ever NIVNA conference I went to many, many years ago, and Sheila Morris was saying that every nurse is a HIV nurse, and just listening to your beautiful accent then and what you were saying, I was just like, oh, you're right, even we've come like 20 years full circle, and actually you're right, every nurse is a HIV nurse.
Absolutely. Do you know, yeah, you know, it's we've got a lot of work still to do. I mean, you know, stigma obviously is one of the big things that, you know, all of us working in HIV, you know, try and battle against and try and change perceptions. Certainly up in Edinburgh, we had a bit of joint working with kind of our community organisation, Waverley Care, and my colleagues in the sexual health clinics and in infectious diseases. And we had stalls, and I mean, it was my colleague Claire who won the case study actually in the last conference. She organised all the stalls in all the hospitals, and so we had lots of ribbons and you know, different things for people to read, sweeties, obviously, because that gathers in nurses.
Absolutely.
And it was in the lead up to World AIDS Day, but we decided that we would tackle stigma rather than kind of giving lots of information. We'd made cards as well about indicator conditions so that doctors could be given those to try. So increase that a little bit. Our main thing was that we wanted to try and change people's perception of stigma. Because obviously Scotland had rolled out that advert, I don't know if you saw it, about stigma, which got kind of mixed reviews. So that came out last October as well. So we kind of were asking people, did you see the advert? And then on the Friday, actually, was it Friday? I think we had a stall in Waverley State, the train station. It was probably the coldest day of the year. And she pulled me in and said, oh, my staff member were short, you have to come. Well, we needed our long johns, and that was sort of cold day. But it's incredible how many people avoided us like the plague as soon as they saw that, you know. So it's, we still have a lot of work to do to try and change perceptions of the general population, you know, hopefully one day.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. And that's kind of, like you said, some of the great work that we're doing as HIV nurses and also NIVNA on the whole as well. But yeah, definitely. So just with that in mind, are you able to share any projects with our listeners that NIVNA are currently developing?
I think, well, the big one is the model of nursing that I know yourself and Eileen Nixon have done an awful lot of work on pulling it together. And that has been going on for probably over a year, actually. And I think you will be introducing it at Beaver, because Beaver kindly gave us some money to help move that forward. And you've kindly agreed to come and speak about it at conference. I think you did a little bit of a showcase at it last year's conference, just to introduce what we're all doing in the different chapters. So basically, it's kind of a model to look at kind of patient-centred care and kind of excellent high quality care, and it looks at lots of different chapters about what is involved in, you know, looking after a person living with HIV, you know. So there's treatments and interventions, testing, stigma, what else, children, sexual health, psychological well-being. So lots of different things that we can look, because it's just looking at everything. I mean, that's always, I think, the really great thing about HIV care, I think, is because it's so holistic and there's always something we can look at, not just the blood numbers, you know. There's always something we can pick up. So this model of care, I think, is going to be great at because it can be used for revalidation, but it just gives signposting about where you can do more reading. And I think it has got the potential to really help as educate the kind of future workforce.
Definitely is, and I kind of echo what you're saying. I think that's the great beauty of working in HIV care, that you say we treat the person and not the virus. So there is so much that we know and get involved in. So it's great to kind of have a model that draws that all together. So mentioned, I think it was it last year's conference, you presented some work on weight management. And as I've been back in my clinical role, I think that's something that's increasingly more prevalent within clinics. You talked a lot around kind of the work you do in Edinburgh. I was just wondering, are you able to share with our listeners an overview of the clinic? And also, like I said, I've noticed more and more patients are coming in with maybe increased BMIs, but also with a desire to think about sort of losing weight, because I know that was something me personally always struggle with. You know, I'm even over talking it now. How do we deal with weight issues within our
people? Yeah, I mean, we're really lucky in Edinburgh because we've got a passionate specialist dietitian who has worked with us. Tracy's been in the unit for years and is on the HIV Dietitians Association, you know, so she's very specialist. And so when the nurses started introducing the annual reviews, you know, part of the section was looking at their lipids and their HbA1c and their weight. And up until that time, it was really kind of ad hoc. We'd send a wee email to Tracy and kind of say, oh, this is a little bit this. And so then we kind of produced our referral sheet, and we became much kind of stricter about the criteria of what we had to list, basically what was going on, like what the Securus 3 score was, that what the concern was. Was it purely weight? Was it because the HbA1c had gone up to about 44? And we saw a real shift, because up until that point, lots of people DNA'd Tracy, our dietitian's clinic. And then when we all went to telephone calls over COVID, Tracy kind of kept that model because it just kind of fitted in better with her work. And so she kind of tends to have the appointment 2 weeks after we've seen them and done the bloods. And so she keeps an eye on them. And so although they are kind of annual review bloods, anybody who's involved with Tracy, they get them every 6 months. And she has done amazing work with some of our patients, and it's all over the phone. And her DNA rate decreased drastically because they didn't have to come into clinic, and so they were happy to take the call. And, you know, so yeah, a lot of patients have lost weight. You know, so she just keeps chipping away. It's just kind of like reinforcement. And if they put on a bit of weight, she's like, well, that's okay, we'll just keep going. Very much follows the kind of Mediterranean diet, and they do all the scoring about what, you know, so it's introducing like nuts, like snacking on nuts and increasing tomatoes and fruit and veg and having oily fish. And, you know, so she goes over all the diet with them. The weight is slightly harder, because obviously it's trying to do exercise as well and look at their cholesterol. But people have lost weight. I mean, weight's an interesting one, because obviously, you know, there's all the talk about whether our NSTIs, new NSTIs, are causing weight gain. And now there's kind of more research thinking that, well, actually, is it because efavirenz and tenofovir disoproxide, is that stopping weight gain rather than TAF and the NSTIs causing weight? So there's a bit of a debate about what actually is the real cause of weight gain. But it is a concern for people that, they tend to not want to switch if they're going weight gain. But I think it's challenging because the general population, the weight is going up, isn't it? You know, and so we are, I think we're, as health professionals, we really are, although it's very difficult to do, we have to try and keep pushing you must exercise, you need to eat healthily, all that kind of thing. It was interesting because at Cape Town, when I was at the conference in November, there was a lot of nurse sessions and even medical sessions on weight gain. And it was interesting them, kind of their perception of it, because obviously, you know, people living with HIV in South Africa want to be big. And so especially, like, you know, one of the doctors was great. Our presentation, you know, she was going, you know, you want, when somebody's newly married, you go, oh, mama, you look great. But she very much was saying, you know, that they have got a huge obesity problem there. And she said, we have to change the mindset that big is healthy, you know, so that you don't, you know, because they thought that living with HIV, you know, you kind of lost all that weight. But she said, we've got to move away from that. We have got to start trying to say to our patients, you must eat healthy. We've got to exercise more. So, at least two sessions a day had kind of weight, and we need to focus on this and not just think blame the drugs. We have to make sure the patients are doing it. So it's a hard one though, isn't it? Do you know?
Yeah, no, definitely. I was just listening to it and I felt really inspired, because I think you're right. As you know, it is something that we're seeing increasingly more in our clinic, and how can we help and support people? And yeah, those kind of narratives around big being better in some kind of cultural aspect, it's a tricky one, isn't it?
Yeah. And I think that, like, doing the HbA1c and seeing the numbers, I think, because a lot of them go, oh, I don't want to take more tablets, I don't want to have to take something to control my blood sugar. So that kind of motivates them a little bit. Even things like honey, like a lot of particularly my African patients actually like their honey and their tea. And so she's had to kind of say, no, that's so it's just small and kind of repetitive messages. I think it's a bit like smoking cessation, isn't it? It's a bit like that. I mean, just repetitive, wee short snippets. I think she is making a difference. But of course, you've got all these new amazing weight loss drugs. I don't know about you, but certainly I'm getting a lot of texts from patients going, "What about this drug? Could I take this to lose some weight?" Do you know? But I said, "Well, I think you'll probably struggle to get it on the market because lots of private GPs are prescribing it to film stars to lose weight. I don't think you're going to find it." But it isn't. These drugs seem incredible, but then obviously as a result they're not available. There's such a shortage, and so people living with diabetes are not able to get them. But you know, seeing what they're able to do with the weight loss, I would imagine that that's going to be a market that's going to expand rapidly.
Yeah, definitely. I think you're right. I think there is a massive market opening up in that area, which is hard because, like you say, people might not have access to that. How do you see kind of the role of the nurse in this? You've kind of mentioned it a little bit. I'm just thinking for myself because this is probably one of my Achilles heels because I always struggle. So what could I do to kind of help me feel more confident? Is there any resources available?
I think we kind of signpost them to Heart UK. That does quite a nice explanation of cholesterol and LDL and non-HDL and the ratios that are, you know, I think it's written quite, that helps them understand a little bit more and what things to eat, because not everybody does want to get referred to the dietitian. They don't like that aspect, so that I kind of signpost them to that. And I think certainly I feel my role now more than ever is health promotion more than anything else now. And you know, healthy health and healthy mind. I think the tablets is the small bit, isn't it? Adherence, you know. You know, it's very different, isn't it? But it's about changing mindset, isn't it? So people living with HIV who didn't think they would be still living, it's very difficult to try and tackle stopping smoking or changing their diet or, anything like that is quite difficult to do, you know? But the tools that you've got now, I think, for, you know, like the QRIS3 example, you know, changing around figures and stuff, it is really great for patients to be able to visualise. See, there you go. If you stop your smoking and become an ex-smoker, look at the difference in that risk, cardiovascular risk, you know. And then, of course, we've got the statins and this big REPRIEVE study that's come out and how the difference it's made on taking a statin. And so it'll be interesting to see what comes of that and whether, you know, because it does seem to be the younger patients with low to moderate risk cardiovascular or an event seem to be the ones that benefited the most in that study. So you wonder, I mean, certainly the majority of my patients say, no, I don't want to take a statin. And obviously, you know, I don't think the GPs are ready for us to say, right, we all please prescribe statins. But it did look quite a startling result, taking a statin, or that particular statin, which we can't get yet, I don't think.
Definitely. And I think, obviously, listening to him reflecting, I guess, if you are kind of somebody working in HIV care that's thinking, oh, how do I broach this subject with my patients or the people I provide care for, then it is those fundamental skills around health promotion, like you've mentioned, around kind of how can we signpost you to places, and also in that supportive, compassionate way that we do anyway, because I know these are a touchy subjects or tricky subjects to explore. And I guess if we have any listeners now listening and they're thinking, oh gosh, I'm worried about my weight, I don't know what to do, then yeah, just check in with your healthcare provider and just get the information that you need to make a decision around what feels comfortable for you. As Linda's mentioned, there's lots of research coming out now that we can help kind of protect cardiovascular health. So it's worth kind of having those conversations with your healthcare provider.
Yeah, I mean, there's so many tools available now that you can get, things like because we've got a big folder, my colleague Claire put together for the annual reviews a lot of website ideas, to direct patients to if they're interested, like Heart UK, and things like calcium, working out if you've got enough calcium, so for women who are menopausal and protecting their bones, but they don't know how much calcium that they actually take in their diet. And there's calculators for things like that that you can signpost people to. And just the same as like there's all these apps for mental health and for sleep. And sleep's a big thing that that's another thing that we kind of flag up at annual reviews. Again, we're very lucky because we have an in-house mental health team, but they're probably referrals that they have, if they look back in the last year, probably are for sleep more than ever, anything else. So that's a big problem. Particularly again with the newer drugs, quite often they have got insomnia as part of the side effects. So it's great that we've got a team that kind of untangle, well, is there other issues ongoing, underneath it all that you've not really addressed, that kind of thing. So again, it's that big picture, isn't it?
Exactly, yeah, definitely. And it's really nice to have this conversation with you around kind of the health promotion, the living longer, that well-being, mental health, considering like we started the conversation with being in infectious diseases wards and kind of thinking about shorter-term care for people. So it's good that we're thinking about developing folders to help support people with living well, as well. Just kind of thinking about that, Linda, what our listeners may not be aware of is that you've recently raised money for NIVNA, undertaking a sponsored walk. I was just wondering, are you able to tell us a little bit more about that?
So that was, I mean, it was just a fantastic, it's called the Hebridean Way. It was, about 156 miles, I think it is. I'm up the kind of northwest of Scotland. It's a whole chain of 10 islands that you have to get about three ferries, but the rest of it is causeways, so you walk between each of the islands. And I planned it anyway, and people thought, wow, that seems quite difficult. I didn't camp, I will be honest. I wasn't camping. I was staying in hostels and different places, but I was still carrying my bag. I had about like a 20 kilo bag pack on my back. But that's my thing. I walk and walk, and so I can't remember why. Obviously, NIVNA, we're trying to look at ways of raising money. Obviously, we are really fortunate that we get sponsorship from pharma still, but it's obviously getting more and more challenging to get that. And if we want to do projects, we have to kind of look at ways of applying for different pots of money and different grants. But also because we're a charity, we can raise funds as well. So that's what I decided to do. I kind of got sponsored up, yeah, and raised over £1,000, which was brilliant actually, because I was on my jollies. I was having quite a nice time. I mean, it was difficult. There was, but it was a nice thing to do. So I think, at one stage, I kind of did a little recording and put it online, which, and I don't like recording myself, but just again to encourage people that if you're ever doing a sponsored event, then think about NIVNA, because we are a charity. You are able to raise funds. It's difficult because obviously there's lots of other charities out there that could do with the money, but it was nice to be able to do that.
Thank you so much, and thanks for sharing that with us. What's probably going to happen now is I'm probably going to make you blush by just informing our listeners that you were announced and received the prestigious title of HIV Nurse of the Year. And can't think of a worthier winner, as I've, like I said, I've had the pleasure of working with you for many, many years now. But I'm just wondering, from your point of view, what did it mean to be awarded HIV Nurse of the Year?
I was mortified, I will be honest. I think, yeah, I think, oh my God, if the ground could swallow me up now, that this would be an ideal time. Yeah. But it was lovely because I think, or certainly afterwards, I mean, I mean, the comments I got from people were just lovely, and they had a big party with balloons and cake and stuff at my work, which was just, it was really lovely to be recognised for the work you do. But I mean, I have to say, I mean, I don't, I've never been the kind of person, I don't like to kind of go out and look for awards or anything, and I'm very much kind of work as a team, and you know, both with, you know, my nurse specialist colleague Claire, and also my colleague Claire, who I worked with before, who is over in sexual health, and we work very well together, the two centres. We, you know, at one stage we were going to go into single kind of single service, which never happened, but we at least can say from the nursing point of view that we do share the same practices, we do try and follow the same protocols and stuff. And, you know, so for me, I felt it was a kind of recognition of all that we do, because I think we do a lot of good things up in Scotland. I mean, I think that's probably why, I mean, we've talked earlier about how we went, you know, joining everything. And I think, well, I mean, Sheila Morris was she was chair for a long, long time, and she was my colleague in, she was research nurse. And I was kind of persuaded to join. But I think it's important. I think, you know, we've hardly got any members in Scotland. I just try and encourage them to join, I have to say. But they always kind of, I think that, well, the conference, it's all about what's happening in England. I said, no, it's not. It's not, because you could come and speak. Do you know, we were first to roll out injectables. We were first to roll out PrEP. Do you know, because we're a smaller nation, we do great things. And so, and I think as well, you know, when I joined NIVNA, it was mainly people from the south that were on the exec, and mainly people from the south that did the conferences, and that is so changed, which is great. And I think that's probably encouraged more people to join the organisation, because I think, you know, we've all got constraints in our service, haven't we, about what we're allowed to do, but it's nice to be able to showcase what's happening in different parts of the country. So yeah, I think it was lovely to get the award. I think I probably was more chuffed about getting the poster about for my annual reviews and raising the profile of nurse-led care, I have to say. But no, it was lovely.
Yeah. So thank you for taking part in the podcast. It's now time to get to know you a little bit better. So can you share with us something that you do as part of your self-care?
I walk for miles and miles, put my headphones on and just walk. So, I mean, I walk to work every day. So that takes an hour. I try my hardest to walk home as well, but it just depends on how late I end up staying at work. But, yeah, that's I walk as much as I can. That's how my mental health. So all the majority of my holidays, particularly my ones in May time, I will walk. So I did that every day anyway. Last year I kind of walked around the island of Mull, and then another big long walk. This time I'm kind of going to other islands, and my friend Caroline and I are doing the Cotswold Way in September. So yeah, I'm happiest with a backpack on and walking anywhere.
Fab. That sounds amazing. Can you share with our listeners a book that you are reading?
I've just finished reading Young Mungo, which is, and of course I can't remember the guy's name, he wrote Shuggy Bear. Basically it's about a young boy who's growing up in Glasgow, and you know, he's in between kind of Catholics and Protestants, quite a hard area, and has to come to terms with sexuality, and his mum's an alcoholic, and it's quite raw and quite hard to read. I mean, it's a bit like one of my all-time I'll read quite a gruesome murder. That's usually my style of book that I read, but now and again I kind of try and move away. And I would say kind of one of my favorite books is The Heart's Invisible Furies by John Boyne, and it's a bit the same as this one. It's kind of a boy who was brought, you know, born to a Catholic teenager, and obviously there was huge family problems, and you know, it's written every 15 years as this boy grows up to be a man, and you know, has you know, kind of ends up having a sexual relationship. Well, he married, which trying to come to terms with his own sexuality, ended up falling in love with a man who then was murdered basically because of his sexuality, and it comes full circle and he goes back to Dublin again. But it kind of, John Boyne had very similar kind of experiences, and he writes a chapter in the book as well. But it's a massive tome, it's 600 pages, and it's really sad, achingly sad at times actually, but also he's an incredibly funny writer, so it's definitely worth a read. That's probably one of my favourite books actually of all time.
I'll definitely get that on my reading list for this summer. Thank you so much. And our last question is probably a toughy question for you, but because there's so much that we can think about. So it can be about anything, but if I had a magic wand and if time, resources and money weren't an issue, what would you like to change or see done differently?
I would like, if all the money in the world, I would like everybody in the world to be able to live whatever they wanted with money and, you know, a roof over their head and food in their bellies. You know, it never ceases to amaze me how, in, you know, we're, you know, 2024 and we've still got so many people homeless and people fleeing countries and then, you know, coming up against barriers. I mean, it breaks your heart when you see people trying to get on a boat to, you know, get a flea and, you know, drown, because there's, you know, it's just impossible, isn't it? So many people in boats, and you just can't imagine how, you know, just desperate these people are to put themselves in that situation in the first place. So all the money in the world, I would say, God, let everybody, you know, live in a house, you know, with money to buy food. In an HIV world, it'd be nice to have money to be able to develop services so that, you know, we could maybe change the model a wee bit and people could access care which was suitable for them, you know, instead of us still having to have this follow-up, come to clinic, you know, do your bloods. It'd be nice if we could develop the service so that, you know, people could, you know, because lots of people travel, don't they, because of, you know, it'd be nice if we could get rid of stigma. I would love that. Completely get rid of stigma. Put lots of money into education in schools and everywhere so that we kind of eradicate stigma. But to be able to build services that means that people living with HIV can go anywhere for follow-up and get the medication, but still have the centre of excellence run by us nurses, of course, that people can tap into. Don't want to talk myself out of a job, obviously.
No, definitely. I love that. Thank you so much, and thank you for sharing your time with us this evening. So thank you, it's been an absolute pleasure.
Well, it's been lovely talking to you, Janelle. Thank you.
Thank you to today's guest and to you for listening to this episode of HIV Matters. I don't know if you're anything like me and are busy writing down the lovely book suggestions made in our show. That's why HIV Matters have teamed up with bookshop.org to bring all these fantastic books to you in one unique place. To find out more about this and how to access the bookstore, please check out today's show descriptions. Today's edition of HIV Matters has been brought to you via an unrestricted educational grant from Vive Healthcare and Gilead Sciences. Gilead and Vive have had no input into guests or topics. HIV Matters is the official podcast of the National HIV Nurses Association. For more information about the National HIV Nurses Association, head over to www.nivna.org. Thanks again for listening to our show. We hope to see you next time, and together we can make a difference.